Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Keisha Bush, author of No Heaven for Good Boys, published by Random House Publishing in 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a great idea. Today, we are drinking the Fairy Godmother inspired by Keisha's book. The recipe is on Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description. If you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Keisha Bush was born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts. She received her MFA in creative writing from the New School, where she was a Riggio Honors Teaching Fellow and recipient of an NSPE Dean's Scholarship. Her debut novel, No Heaven for Good Boys, is a New York Times Editor's Choice. Author Juno Diaz says of No Heaven for Good Boys, quote, an extraordinary literary debut, as mesmerizing as it is heartbreaking. Keisha Bush is an amazing storyteller, by turns harrowing and tender, and no matter how difficult the journey, she never lets us lose sight of the two young cousins who are the beating, hopeful, loving heart of this triumphant must-read novel. Wow, amazing praise there.
In No Heaven for Good Boys, 6-year-old Ibrahima loves snatching pastries from his mother's kitchen, harvesting string beans with his father, and searching for sea glass with his sisters. But when he is approached in his rural village one day by Marabou Ahmed, a seemingly kind stranger and highly regarded teacher, the tides of his life turn forever. Ibrahima is sent to the capital city of Dakar to join his cousin Etienne in studying the Quran for a year. But instead of the days of learning that Ibrahima's parents imagined, the young boys, called Talibay, are forced to beg in the streets in order to line their teacher's pockets. To make it home, Etienne and Ibrahima must help each other survive both the dangers posed by their marabou and the darker sides of Dakar. Drawn from real incidents and transporting readers between rural and urban Senegal, No Heaven for Good Boys is a tale of hope, resilience, and the affirming power of love.
How are you feeling today, Keisha?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Heather.
Good. Well, we're really looking forward to talking with you about your work and especially to hearing you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I've been with this story for so long and I love the character so much. Reading it is a little different for me. I don't feel like I'm reading a story. I guess oral storytelling was such a part of my own family that sharing stories, telling stories just feels somewhat natural.
Yeah. Did you give many readings of this book in the last few months? How active have you been out there interacting with people?
It's been really interesting because of the pandemic. I sold No Heaven for Good Boys in 2016. So it was acquired by Random House or Penguin Random House back then. So there was no idea of a pandemic, but it was a mountain to climb and there was a lot of internal things going on. And I've been with a lot of different editors because there's a lot of turnover within publishing. So my first two editors separated from Penguin Random House. And then my third editor also separated from Penguin Random House, and then my fourth and fifth, who are an editorial team, way more stable, but it was a 5-year process.
Oh, wow.
And so like Zoom is the reality. And so I've given quite a few Zoom readings.
I was going to ask, what was the origin story for this novel? What drew you to write about the Talibay?
So when I was living in West Africa, I first lived in the Gambia, but after a couple of months, I moved to Dakar. And when I was there, I was staying with the family, a friend of mine in New York. So he's Senegalese, and we were friends. And so when I decided to go to Dakar, I knew no one. So I called him back up in New York, and I said, hey, do you have family in Dakar? Because I know you're Senegalese. And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, is it possible if I stay with them? I'd like to visit. So he said, let me check with my mom. We talk again a couple of days later. She had said yes. So that's how I initially got to Senegal. And after I stayed with his mom and sister, one of his sisters was home from the U.S. I stayed with them for 2 weeks, returned to the Gambia, and then a month later decided to move permanently to Dakar. So I was taking French classes, meeting expats, American expats. And I kept seeing these kids asking me for money. So I just started to inquire to anyone I knew, both local and expat, and everyone had their versions of this story. The Americans were like, oh, those kids are so dirty. I don't let them touch me. But these marabous abused them and forced them to beg. And locals at the time, and you have to think, this is 2005, 2004. The locals were just like, well, it's our tradition. Boys are supposed to suffer. And this is what brings them to manhood. And I'm like, I think these kids are abused.
Yeah.
So now let's fast forward to 2009 when I had this, I'm back in the U.S. for maybe a year. And I have this epiphany where I'm just like, working 90 hours a week for a nonprofit, not making any money. It was a toxic workspace. And I'm like, this is not my dream for the rest of my life. Like, this cannot be. I've done all of these things, you know, lived in West Africa, traveled through Europe for work when I began working with Oxfam Great Britain. And so I started writing and I wrote a book in 2009 and I thought it was going to be the greatest thing ever until I reread it. And I'm like, wow, I really overwrote this story. Like, I write when the character blinks, very detailed oriented.
Wow.
And so in 2010, I decided to try free writing, which I still do. And
this, me too.
Yeah, it's so important to just free write because you often just get the chatter out and you can find gems in it. And there's no like, I'm going to free write for 3 days and find a story. It could be, I'm going to free write and something might come out of it in 3 months.
Or it might not.
Exactly. Exactly. And you have to be okay with that, because it is part of the process. And so I was free writing, and the story of a boy and his grandfather came forth. And after 3 pages, it died. And these people were American. The grandfather was telling a story. So then maybe like a month or so later, a month or two later, I sat down and a mosque came to me. And I said, oh, okay, which mosque is this? I've been in several. And there's a mosque on 96th Street and 3rd Avenue that I've been inside of. But it wasn't that mosque. This mosque was in Senegal. But when I looked at the outside of the mosque, I realized it wasn't in Dakar. It was further, it felt like it was really close to the beach, which might be like in the south of Senegal. And so what I did is I saw someone on the outskirts of the mosque, but I decided to go inside. And when I went inside, there were the skylights and there was nobody inside. And I could taste the salt from the ocean on the breeze that was sort of washing through the mosque. And I said, is this mosque day, which is Fridays across the world? Right. And I think it was. And then after sort of writing a paragraph or two about what this mosque looked like inside, I had to do the who, what, why, when, and where, because I'm curious. I said, where is this mosque? And it's in southern Senegal. So then I looked at literally at a Google map of the south of Senegal and found this village. I sort of like made the village up. So Sally Lou is not a real village, but I know exactly where this fake village or this mythical village would exist on the border towards the beach. And then from there, I said, who are the villagers? Because this mosque is near a village. And so then I went to explore the village. And when I explored this village, I found this family. And when I found this family, I found that their youngest son was going to become a Taliban. And that actual beginning is chapter 5 in the book. So what the literal beginning, and that is literally how it happened, eventually became chapter 5 with the family. And instead of me showing my origins of finding this mosque, finding this village and this family, and then Ibrahima, who is the protagonist of the story, the way this chapter is written is the family's going to mosque. It was mosque day. It was really fascinating. And as I wrote it, when I found the family and I started writing this story, I knew that I had found the story. And it's based on No Heaven for Good Boys, which wasn't titled at that time, that I knew that I was going to take a chance on changing careers and pursuing being a novelist full time.
Wow.
So many things came from that moment.
It really did.
That's amazing. And then the fact that chapter 5 was really kind of in your mind, the starting point, because I was very struck by the first chapter of this book. I thought it was kind of brilliant that you put these boys at the zoo and had this very vivid first chapter here. How did that first chapter happen? How did that get to be your choice for how to begin the book if chapter 5 did not?
Okay, so... What an interesting, such a cool conversation, because I love talking about this and I love hearing the origin stories from other writers also. I just think it's fascinating how these works of art come together. And chapter 2 was the original chapter 1 after the beginning of the story became chapter 5. Did you follow that?
I was on it. I got it. Totally there.
Okay. So chapter 2 was the original first chapter for several years. And in 2016, my acquiring editor asked me to slow the story down because chapter 2 just sort of throws the reader right into action. Although if you read everything about becoming a writer, they always say start with action.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you get an editor at a big house and you get the exact opposite. They're like, slow it down. So I originally slowed it down. And when I thought about how I would slow it down, I thought about Dakar Zoo, which actually exists, and which I had always wanted to send the boys, but hadn't found an opportunity within the story to send them to the zoo. And so when I thought about, okay, if I'm going to add a new beginning, sending them to the zoo is my opportunity. Marabou can be away. He does travel at times throughout the story. I don't have to give feedback or the backstory as to where he is. Who cares? Originally, the way I slowed it down when I shared it with those first editors, I was told that I had slowed it down too much. So I was just like, okay, what are you really asking of me? And so in 2017, because I had written this new beginning in 2016. So in 2017, which is the very last really big revision I did, I just sort of condensed the new version of chapter 1. I condensed it down to have it move a bit quicker. But it was really important to me. And I think after being with this story for so long, that I was a different writer. I had already, by 2017, I had already written two other novels, a memoir and then another fiction manuscript. So I had two additional books under my belt, and I had already finished my MFA at the New School. And so the writer that I was in 2010, when I wrote that first draft, and then in 2011 and in 2012, I had rewritten the book from scratch. So if you think from 2012 to 2017, here are these 5 years where I finished two more books, and then I go back into No Heaven for Good Boys to really expand the book. I'm a different writer and feel really lucky and blessed, and I know I've worked really hard for it, but I don't know how other writers or other artists feel, but I feel like you can put as much work into something and put all your dedication and your passion and your blood and your sweat and your tears into something. And there's a possibility that you don't pull it off, you know?
Right.
And so the chapter one that exists now, I feel really blessed that I was able to pull that off, you know, and set the tone. I already knew the story. I know these characters, like they're real people, they're such a part of me. And Ibrahima, the protagonist, I'll be very honest, he is my mini-me.
Wow.
I love him so much. And if I don't have children, but if I had children and I had two boys, they would be like Ibrahima and Etienne.
You know, I was going to tell you when you were talking earlier that when you were mentioning about bringing them to the zoo, like, they sounded like your kids.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to take the kids to the zoo in this story. And I really like that. And they did. They felt very real. The other thing I want to say, and then I think Heather has a question for you, is that I need to go back and read the book now because I want to read chapter 5 as if it was the first chapter. And I want to read chapter 2 as if it was the first chapter because I'm curious now.
Awesome.
See, she's already sending us back to her book. We read it one time. Now it has to happen again.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I thought, speaking of the two boys, that it was fascinating to have these two boys at the crux of what's essentially a very dark narrative. It was very powerful to have these children there because, of course, you're taking your reader with you, hoping and dreading if anything is going to happen to them. Had you written from children's points of views before, is my first question. And second question is, how did you make decisions on representing their abuse and trauma inflicted by adults in this novel?
So the very first book I ever wrote was in 2009. And that's the book that I overwrote. Like, it was overwritten. And it was from the perspective of two young girls, two young Black American girls and their friendship. And they were, you know, they're based in the South. And I think before I wrote that book, the book that I had always wanted to write was my memoir, this story about my own childhood and looking at the very unorthodox upbringing that me and my siblings had. And so I think with that very first book, which is on a, you know, shelf collecting dust, I call it my training wheels.
Mm-hmm. And I have one of those.
I think that it's really important to have training wheels as an artist. So many people are like, I'm going to write my first book and I'm really impatient about it. And then it needs to go out into the world. And it's just like, it's okay to write a manuscript and then chuck it to the side and start that next book.
Yeah.
You're a better writer for it. You know, don't you want to create the best work possible? The manuscript that I finished third was the memoir. So I finally got the memoir done. And the next fiction book, my characters are adults. So I think by exploring this really human rights crisis that's happening in Senegal with the Taliban and wanting to write these boys' stories because they don't have the agency and the platform to share their story with the world, I think as an adult who grew up in a very violent and unsafe world and didn't have anyone to rescue me or to protect me, I am exploring that in No Heaven for Good Boys also. And when I rewrote, rewrote the entire book from scratch in 2011 and 2012, I was lucky enough to have found a new Buddhist meditation community in Manhattan. And I was also, by coincidence, because of my prior job that was so toxic, I had sought out a therapist. So I was in psychotherapy also. And I wasn't in psychotherapy to write a book. I was in psychotherapy to like deal with my many
issues.
Exactly. And between therapy and my Buddhist meditation practice, my Buddhist meditation teachers, I was supported enough that I was able to delve into some of my own childhood experiences and bring them forth in the story of the Taliban, because I wasn't able to do that in that first draft at all. And I don't like other people suffering. And so the book was actually really hard for me to write because I remember my writing teacher. I wasn't in the MFA program at New School yet. I had taken 4 continuing education classes with the same professor. And the class was called Revise and Edit with John Reed. And I took his class 4 times in a row. And over the course of 3 of those classes, I rewrote No Heaven for Good Boys and got his feedback and, you know, workshopped it with classmates. But I remember him saying to me at one point, you can't keep saving the boys in the book, Keisha. because if they're not experiencing that for real in Senegal, and you're trying to write with a level of truthfulness, you have to write that story. But this story was so, it was so hard for me to write and even edit and revise over the years, you know? And so I didn't write this with like a lightheartedness because I was trying to get a reaction. If people, you know, Google and read the journalism that is out there about the Taliban, CNN has something called the Freedom Project. And so if you Google CNN Freedom Project, you'll find that CNN is dedicated to eradicating and ending modern day slavery. And in 2019, they shot a documentary about the Taliban in Senegal, and it's called Begging for Change. And, you know, it took so long for this book to come out into the world. I thought by the time the book comes out in the world, the Taliban would have been, someone would have, the government would have changed things for them, because this is what these children deserve. They have families. These are not orphans. And instead, it's still going on. And, you know, once you read No Heaven for Good Boys and you go and you watch that documentary, you realize how much I didn't put in the book, how much I still tried to write a story where it wasn't just all about sadness. And in my author, I worked with Human Rights Watch for my author's note at the end of the book, and they helped me locate and highlight three grassroots nonprofits that are working with the Taliban in Senegal. And, you know, it was really important for them and for me to, you know, list organizations that are run, that were started and run by Senegalese people. So two of them are, and one of them is Maison de la Guerre, MDG. And that is the nonprofit that is actually highlighted in the work that MDG is doing, is highlighted in the documentary with CNN. I see this book as part of a conversation and also like a form of activism for children, for the Taliban, but all children. Like, children do not deserve to be hurt. And I'm reading currently The Body Keeps Score, which has taken me years to read, only because I'm reading faster. I think when you're dealing with trauma and trauma in the body, instead of saying, I should have read this book 5 years ago or 3 years ago, it's like, I'm ready to read it now. Mm-hmm. And I just passed part three, where they talk about childhood trauma. And one of the doctors is quoted as saying, like, you know, child abuse is an epidemic in America, but it's an epidemic across the world, you know, and it's an ongoing epidemic, and our societies and our world suffers from it. And I'm really passionate about so many things, but especially protecting children. And so as I was writing The Boy's Perspective, that was the thing that was one of my biggest challenges. It was also the hardest part, trying to stay truthful to sort of the childhood understanding of the world around them. And many of the things in the book, I like to explain No Heaven for Good Boys, or explain it as the scaffolding of No Heaven for Good Boys is nonfiction. And then I took fictional characters and I put them in that nonfiction scaffolding. So a lot of the things that happen in the book actually happen, actually exist, aside from Salalou being this sort of imaginary village. Dakar is very real, because that is where I lived. The uprisings by the students at Dakar University did happen and do happen on a yearly basis. And the one that I show in the book is one that happened. And when the boys end up walking onto the soldiers, you know, falling, you know, kind of falling out of the Hummer and setting up this big bazooka, that was me who experienced that, because I had no idea what the big booms were. you could hear them all throughout Dakar, but I was really hungry that afternoon, so I was going for lunch at the local like patisserie in Pointe-Aux that was, you know, not far from my house. And when I go out onto the Rue de Wacom, I'm like, oh my God, this looks like a war zone.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, what's going on?
I just wanted a snack.
Yes, I was literally, I was specifically going to get a quiche because the quiche at this like patisserie was so good. And I'm just like, you know, hopping along, walking along, you know, to my own rhythm. And I'm just shocked at what I see. And you end up, you know, I write about it in the book. And then the soldiers see me because I'm like, I wonder, I don't just turn around. I'm like, I wonder if the patisserie is open in the middle of all of this. let me go see.
Jeez, like that's seriously wanting your snack.
Yes, yes. And these, you know, Senegalese soldiers turn around and they're like, you know, in French, they're like, what are you doing? Get out of here. You know, it's not safe. And so what I do is the boys, Etienne and Ibrahima and Talibé, they're out on the street almost 12 hours a day begging, you know, trying to raise this quota to bring back to their, you know, teacher of the Quran, this Marabou Ahmed. And I'm like, so they would be out there. What, how would a child react? Because I know I was pretty like, I had never seen that before in real life, just only on TV. So I was a little like fascinated with it, like, oh my God, you know? And so how would these like a 6-year-old and a, you know, 10-year-old, how would they respond to this? An 11-year-old, like, whoa, this is, look at the Hummer and look, ooh, the big bazooka. And the only time that they would actually run, you know, because they're hiding from the soldiers. But when they run is when they get hit with the back, when the wind shifts and the tear gas that's being exploded onto the campus pushes back onto the soldiers, but the soldiers have gas masks, but you know, the kids don't. And so throughout this world, so I take these 4 years and I condense them into a year in the story. And it's like, how, so I constantly would ask myself, how would Ibrahima, seeing this for the first time, react to it? But at one point, I was also really curious about the rhythm of how children speak. And at 6 years old, there is a rhythm to a child's speech. So if I was out in public and I was on the bus, I would sit next to a family just to hear their kids talk to them. How do these little ones talk again? And I was, for a short time, I was a substitute teacher at a school down in West Village, and I was substituting for kindergarten, and they were the best. And then I also would babysit for a friend of mine who had a 1-year-old, and then I babysat for them for 5 years, and they had a second child. So I had like these years to just listen. And it's fascinating because my friend's children, they love me because I listen to them. I would like just go, hey, you all, how are you doing? Tell me everything. They could talk for hours because they can too.
Wow. And the kids are like, I love her. She just laughs and she's so fun.
Literally. Absolutely. And so, you know, that's how I quote unquote did a little bit of research, because the rhythm in which children speak, I felt like it was enough, there was consistency enough. And then I also interacted with the Talibé in Senegal. Towards the beginning of the story, there's a man who buys them, you know, Coca-Cola.
I remember that scene.
Yeah, I was actually that man. And he says what I said, because I remember looking at them and I'm like, do you all want water? And they looked at me like I had 3 heads. Like, what are you talking about, lady? We don't want water. We want Coca, you know? It's called, you know, they don't say Coca-Cola. They like Coca. And I was their banana girl. So there was a group of boys in Pointe-Aux that I you know, learn to recognize, and they would recognize me, and I would buy them bananas. When I first went to Senegal, I was living off of savings, and then I started teaching English. And at one point, I only was making $240 a month, and my rent was $140 a month. I had $100 for transportation down to teach my students in downtown Dakar and food. And so I would have these clusters of 10, 13 boys. Like, yeah, I want a banana. And bananas were cheap enough that I could buy 10 bananas for $2. So I became the banana. You know, they would see me and they're like, banana, 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 banana. And I'm like, okay. So over the years that I lived in Senegal, and then when I got a job with Oxfam Great Britain, I was like, they broke Oprah, let me tell you. I was like, pizza for you, jelly sandals for you, like whatever you boys want. It's like, you know, it's Christmas every day that you see me.
That's kind of beautiful. Why didn't you make the benefactor female then? I noticed there's a couple of male benefactors, or there's a couple of nice characters who give some sort of charity. Was there a reason you made the character male who gave them the cocas?
Yeah. So I was looking for a balance, because one of the things that I experienced when I was there is the response from Senegalese people, especially the poor Senegalese people. They would bless me and thank me for my generosity. And it was both men and women. And a couple of true story moments in the book, one of them is the French family. And when I was
love the French family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the French family actually exists. And that's what they do. And I think that they've been there for a really long time. Any Talibay, and it, you know, the way word of mouth exists, word of mouth in Senegal is strong. Like if you hear something, there's a real close chance, especially if you hear it from multiple people, that it is actually true. And so the French family who lives downtown, any will feed any Talibay that come to their house. And so I felt like that was really important. The doctors on the hill at the lighthouse really would fix the feet of any Talibay that came to the lighthouse. The mother, the American mother who is married to the Senegalese man and has a son, Mustafa, this wealthy family,
right,
actually represent 2 to 3 like Black American women that I met who were married to Senegalese men who did not know each other, but, you know, I was friends with them, and who told me in confidence that they had taken in Talibay and fed them, clothed them, and allowed them to watch TV. And that if their husbands had ever found out, they would be livid. And so I combined these three women into this one woman, and Mustafa as this friend who interacts with them. And it also gave me the opportunity to teach them English, which is really fun.
You know, I have a question about that, because I love those moments and those characters. And so much of the novel is dark or sad or hard to read, but you really have some wonderful moments of love and light and beauty. And I'm wondering, as you were drafting it, were you aware of the placement of those kinds of moments, or did they just organically happen?
Oh, that's interesting. No, they organically happened. And I think for me, what was important, I think it was just sort of this organic balance that I knew had to happen.
Maybe you could just feel the currents of light and dark moving in the book, and you kind of knew when you wanted to bring it up and when you were going to bring it down. Was that the case?
I think so. I would have to say yes, because I also have to grapple with those dark moments. I'm the one who has to write them, and I didn't want to write them. Like, I sort of begrudgingly wrote these scenes that, you know,
I think that was totally there. And I also think that what was really interesting to me was the idea of the difference between actuality of practice and ideological purpose of the whole Talibay and Marabout structure in the Daras, and which is the Senegalese term to designate the traditional Quranic schools for providing the young children Islamic education. So in theory, I felt like the marabu or the school leader was supposed to be teaching religion.
Mm-hmm.
But in your book, the two main characters, marabu, is horrible, of course. Mm-hmm. He instead uses the talibes for no instruction, but instead maltreatment and taking their begging money, tithes for his personal use, and many things like that. So there was a lot of sad instances where religion was used kind of as an excuse for asking for money, like on religious holidays, but not really the reason behind the character's actions. Did you feel like when you were writing this that you wanted to use the book as a commentary on religious hypocrisy as well as the sad commentary on the Talibé's life?
Yes. So I grew up Jehovah Witness, which is, you know, very orthodox in the way they practice Christianity. And when my mother divorced my father, I was about 6.5 years old, she started seeing someone else. And he was Muslim, a Black Muslim. And so I went from sort of like one sort of extreme or orthodox practice of religion to another. And then when I got to my teens, they had a falling out. They eventually divorced. And in my sort of early adulthood, found and stumbled upon Buddhism. And I've practiced Buddhism ever since. I'm not anti-religion, though. I think religion is really fascinating. And I grew up on the Bible stories and then having to relearn the Bible stories to sort of understand them from the Islamic perspective. And so I say all of this because when I was in Senegal, when my friends found out that I actually practiced Islam as a child, they're like, ah, you're still Muslim and you practice Buddhism. We don't care about that. That's fine. And oftentimes when I talk to people who are Christian, they think I'm Christian also in the way that I just sort of regard religion. I'm not anti, but I do believe that both religion and tradition and these sort of societal structures should be looked at with a critical eye, because they are used to abuse people and to take power over the bodies of the innocent. And it's a larger conversation about how humans abuse their power over one another. So you have this abuse of children because they are without very much agency and they are at the sort of mercy of the adults in the world. And then you have religion that takes a role of power also over the people, right? And this was really important to show because these marabouts, even as adult Senegalese and adult Muslim people are like, you know what? I don't want to send my children to do this. We're hearing rumors. And these rumors were really true and really happening back in 2004 to 2008. When I was in Senegal, the rumors were making their way back into the south and into the villages across the country that these children in the city, their children, are being abused. And so parents stopped, you know, they started to say, no, I'm not sending my kid. But they were being pressured. You want to be a good Muslim. You want to, you know, be a good person in the face of God. But also in the book, I show how these marabouts started to go over the borders into Burkina Faso and Guinea and Mali to take kids from there, where word hadn't spread so quickly that these children are actually living in a human rights crisis, like they're being forced into slavery. And no one in Senegal, in terms of class structure, the worst and the lowest that you can be is a beggar. You don't want to be a beggar or a slave. So nobody would knowingly or purposely send their children into that situation. And so, you know, it's important to show that religion is being used as this mechanism, as this facade for men who are looking to make money, because oftentimes in the villages, if you don't have land and you're not a farmer, or if you're dealing with drought, how do you take care of your family? Well, at this point, you can put on a boo-boo, black boo-boo, which is the outfit, and you put on a turban and you put on dark sunglasses, because regular Senegalese people can't wear sunglasses, which is also a health crisis, because you have NGOs and doctors trying to get Senegalese people to wear sunglasses to protect their eyes from this really strong sun. But
wow,
religion
so,
comes in.
Yeah, so that's incredible. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of people who can't wear sunglasses and their eyes are being negatively impacted?
Absolutely. Wow. So you'll see a lot of elderly with like cataract or other eye issues and beyond cataracts. But I ended up talking to somebody within the NGO world, within the medical world, and they were like, you know, it's a big push because now they're dealing with a cultural thing, whereas only marabouts are trusted to hide their eyes away from God.
Hmm.
They're the only ones who can wear sunglasses.
You know, you said something before that I was interested in talking to you about with the abuse of power. For me, was one of the themes, the central themes of the novel, and just especially how Ahmed had it and wielded it so brutally over the boys, his wife, and just it's like this cruel dictator. And I was curious, I don't want to give all of it away for those people who haven't read the book, but did you know what would happen to this character from the beginning when you started writing about him? Did you know what how things would go at the end of the book, or did it come to you as you were writing?
So I think I've mentioned before how much I love the characters. I mean, I love them like they're human people in a very visceral way. And I despise Marabout Ahmed. Like I,
so do we.
I hate him.
So do we.
And so I wasn't completely sure what would happen to him. And when it did, I was extremely happy. And then I was made to change it. So there's a different version in the book than the version that I actually wanted.
Oh, okay. Well, after you're going to have to tell us.
Yes, I will tell you. I will tell you. I had to, you know what I'll say here, and this is not giving it away. I had to extend the scene. And so I think that will, for anyone who's read the book, you'll understand what this extended scene is. And yeah, so because I disliked the marabout, I hated him. Despised him. I don't like to use the word hate, but despise is a great word. Because I felt so strongly towards him, I actually sought to give him a piece of myself in the story so that I can continue to write him and to ensure that he had some depth to him. Because when I was in workshops at New School, I had a couple of classmates ask me, well, why don't you like dive in deeper into his psychology? And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't care what his psychology is.
Yeah.
And if you think about the Weinsteins of the world, Epstein, I don't care about their backstory at all. What they do, what they're doing to people who they think are weaker than them is wrong. And that's that. I'm more interested in the people who are surviving it, who find the resiliency to get through it. But, you know, we already have books like Lola, Lolita. You go into the psychology of why this person's doing that. I don't need to rewrite that psychology of somebody who, an abuser. So,
no, I mean, to a certain extent. Yeah. And to a certain extent, when you have a malignant, abusive, sadistic person, how much do you really need to explain about that?
I mean, yeah.
I think the survivor is more interesting, if I'm hearing you correctly there. What happens to the people who are impacted
Absolutely.
By those individuals is more interesting to me. But I agree with you. You needed to make that character more complex enough
mm-hmm.
for it to really make the story as interesting as possible, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested, though, because I'm always focused when I'm reading in gender. And I'm interested in the way gender comes into play in Ibrahima's story, particularly in the way his mother, who loved him so much and was so tender with him, was overruled by the societal pressures on the family to not lose their inheritance by angering the husband's brother, who controls his use and possible ownership of the land. So to me, there was a lot of variation between the bad conduct of the marabou and just the culturally conditioned ways of being of other characters in the book, whether they be male or female, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we spent a lot of time with the mother that was just heartbreaking as she's yearning to have her child back. Can you speak to what you kind of hoped to show or shine a light on in terms of gender dynamics in this story?
Yeah. When I was in Senegal, I have to say this: my community, I had an American expat community, and Senegal is a melting pot. It's very Senegalese, but you have a Dutch community, a Korean community, Chinese, Japanese, Indian, American, French, I mean, German, go on. Like, and those are the, you know, people from the West. Everyone in Africa is there. South Africa, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Morocco. So, and I say that because my Senegalese community, amongst others, really took me in. I think they were curious. You don't have as many Black Americans. Black Americans are in Africa, in Senegal, but just not as many as maybe like white Westerners. And so there was a curiosity about me, and I was curious about them. And so I was really brought in like an extended family member, is how I saw it and how I felt with them. Like they were extended family members. And so I feel like I got a very close sort of view of life. And I had what I call American, what do I call them? I would call a group of friends of mine Senegalese expats because they were Senegalese. They were, most of them had been born in Senegal, but they spent most of their life in the US, Canada, or in Europe. And they were all back home for various reasons, both male and female. And all pretty much probably in their 20s and 30s, and really struggling with their individuality and the global person that they were, and the expectations from their family to fall in line back in this way of like tradition. And to give an example, a friend of mine was a lesbian and was back home early 20s and, you know, wears pants, but in so many situations was expected to wear more feminine clothing and to wear a skirt in front of other family members. And this would help her mother because her children are conforming, or things like marriage. And I saw how they all just struggled and grappled with it. And I personally came to the conclusion that I wouldn't want to be a man or a woman beholden to these somewhat like expectations of you coming from such an individual sort of world here in the US. And so I had sort of this bird's eye view where I was welcomed, but no one expected me to fall in line with what a Senegalese woman would be expected to do. And I felt lucky in that because I didn't have that pressure. And so in the book, I felt it was really important to show just how complex being a woman, being a mother, being a village member, a member of society was, and how complex it was to be a husband, a father, a brother, because it's, people can look at the world. And people do. People look at one another and they're full of opinion all the time. You should be doing this. And if you don't, if things aren't perfect for you, then it's because somehow you're at fault or you're lacking as a human. And I'm like, life is way more complex than that. And I try to show that. One of my early editors at one point clearly hadn't really read the book with understanding. Sends a note and says, I just don't understand why the family doesn't hop in a car, drive up to Dakar and get their kid. And I'm like, hold up. Did you not read the book? They can't. And if this is a possibility, then we would not have a situation in 2021, or at the time it was like 2017, 2018, where we, you know, there's up to 100,000 boys who are suffering within the system. The marriage, yeah. Once you hand your kid over, he is his legal guardian. Everybody knows here in the U.S., if the state takes your kid away, you cannot go to the address that your child is at and just take them back. You'll end up in jail.
Yeah, that really came through, too, in the book. Well, this is super fascinating, and we are looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from No Heaven for Good Boys. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is the Fairy Godmother, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make it and enjoy it while you listen. The ingredients include an ounce of gin, an ounce of elderflower liqueur, an ounce of fresh lemon juice, and 2 ounces of sparkling pink rosé. You put everything but the rosé in a shaker and shake it, strain it, and then you pour the rosé. I'm drinking a mocktail today with alcohol-free rosé, lemon juice, and elderflower soda. And it's pretty delicious, too.
Awesome.
Can I just say this cocktail is just so me.
Yay! I'm so glad. That's great.
It really is. I love rosé anything. Champagne, sparkling wine, and elderflower is just, I love elderflower everything also.
Yeah, I do too. I could have it in anything that I drink, just about.
Absolutely.
So glad you like it. That makes me happy.
Yes. Yay.
Well, Keisha, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're going to read from today?
So I am going to read a passage from chapter 28. The morning is slow, and the boredom of not having anything to do threatens to put Ibrahima back to sleep. It's nowhere near lunchtime yet, when he and Etienne will go visit Mustafa. Now that their friend has returned to Dakar, and school is on summer recess, they can visit for the entire afternoon, watching television, playing video games, learning to skateboard, eating good food, and practicing their English. All before Mustafa's father comes home from work, of course, which is when they take leave so that he doesn't find them there. How much is Magic Land? He asks his cousin. That would be a good way to fill the morning, and with all the money they have been collecting during the last 2 weeks of Ramadan, surely they can afford it. Too expensive. It's 2,500 francs. How much is that? Etienne ponders the question for several moments, counting silently on his fingers. A week's pay. Ibrahim's shoulders drop in defeat. He could justify one day's worth of Marabou's money, but not an entire week. But he deserves to spend a day at Magic Land after all he has had to endure over the last few weeks. Are you sure? Maybe we should just try, Ibrahim says, hope still alive in the pit of his stomach. Why do you think no Talibé ever goes to Magic Land? Those rich people don't want to be anywhere near us, even if we could afford it. They keep the price high to keep us out. Ibrahima knows his cousin is right. He rarely ever stares them wrong. Magic Land is stupid anyways, Etienne says. No, it's not, Ibrahima says. Etienne rolls his eyes and leaves Ibrahima to sulk alone. Even if he could earn that much money, he knows spending it on Magic Land would be a waste. Food and paying Marabou are his two priorities. He scratches at his arm and discovers a mosquito bite. His dirty fingernails scrape the bump until his skin burns. When he realizes Etienne is walking away, he jumps up to follow him. Ibrahima drags his can alongside his body, the empty canister bumping into his thigh. Where are we going? Ibrahima asks. To meet the others over there, Etienne says, pointing to the larger group of boys from their house. And then we go to the lighthouse. What's up there? Doctors who will fix our feet. Ibrahima looks down at his feet housed in the blue plastic jelly sandals Aria brought him. Why haven't we gone before? We never have the time. Are you going to get your feet fixed? Ibrahima says. I don't know, Etienne says, tilting his head to the side. It depends. On what? On how long they say it takes to heal. They catch up with the boys and Etienne slaps hands with fatigue, and the two boys fall into an easy gait. Ibrahima frowns. His feet were a constant thing of suffering for months. Etienne would try and soothe him with the advice that one day, once his toes healed and got hard, they wouldn't hurt and bleed so badly again. He didn't think the day would ever come, but it did. He would rather not do anything to cause that kind of pain again. A young girl walks past, dragging her feet in a gait of slow suffering beneath the scorching African sun and the effects of fasting. The ends of her cornrows stick up, haphazardly, around the crown of her head, offering no protection. She wears an old t-shirt tucked into her traditional Senegalese ankle-length wrap skirt and twirls a small plastic bag that dangles from her wrist. Ibrahima would never think to ask her for money, as she is but a maid, a young girl pulled out of school to go live with a family and work 7 days a week, with a day and a half off once a month to go visit her family in the village. Her entire salary of $30 a month is given to her family back in the village. So even if she had a 5-franc piece to spare, she could not afford to give it to a Taliban. The older boys at the front of the group push one another in jest and turn around, their eyes watching her narrow hips sashay by like an older woman with curves. A boy clicks his tongue at her, but with her chin jutting out, she continues on as if she had not heard. The boy's antics fall flat with Ibrahima, a girl with no money to spare. He doesn't see the fun in harassing her. "Have you gone to the lighthouse before?" Ibrahima asks Fatik. Fatik shakes his head no. He turns around and glances at the retreating girl. Why do they bother the girl? She has no money. "They're not interested in her money," Etienne says. "Then why do they tease her?" "Because they want her to be their girlfriend," Fatik laughs. Ibrahima scrunches his face up in disgust. "Yeah, I don't want a girlfriend." Fatik shakes his head. "You're young. Wait till you get older." "No, I'm fine. I don't need a girlfriend. I just want my mom." A man dressed in a worn t-shirt and dusty workman's pants, both too large for his thin angular frame, brushes by Ibrahima as if he were not there. Some people are not worth the time it takes to ask for money. He knows who will say no from several blocks away. People are not aware that the way they move, the manner in which they regard their surroundings, and their facial expression say more about them than the words that come out of their mouths or the clothes they wear. There are some days, though, when his feet hurt, his belly aches, and his skin is so hot from the merciless sun that he would approach a ram for food or money. But today, during the slow but abundant month of Ramadan, he can take a moment and look up at the faces and shoulders of the world around him. He always thought what he really needed was a lot of money, but he has come to realize that what it is he truly needs is time. Time to find food to fill his belly, time to work, time to find his way back home, time to be a boy. Ferdi Mamel sits in front of the boys. The lighthouse is atop one of the two looming hills covered in grass. The story told by the elders is that the twin hills are remnants of a woman who threw herself into the sea off the coast of Dakar, only to be rejected by the sea gods, who tossed her back onto the land, which then grew over and around her. The lasting proof of her existence are the two hills, said to be her breasts, which mark the beginning of the low-key residential neighborhood of Mamal. The group starts up the steep and winding hill, but Ibrahima finds his small chest has trouble catching enough wind to conquer the hill with ease. He stops for a moment, leans over, and coughs phlegm, then spits it out onto the ground in front of him. "Are you okay?" Fatik asks, hitting him on the back. Etienne is beside him a moment later. "Cousin, what's wrong?" Ibrahima stands up and catches his breath. "I don't know. I'm fine." "Perhaps you need a drink." He is quite thirsty now that Etienne mentions it. A Coca-Cola would soothe his cough for sure. "Come," Etienne says, taking his tomato can and leading him up the hill. "We're almost there." Seagulls circle above the tall white lighthouse that looms above the city. Ibrahima shades his eyes against the glare of the sun to get a clear look at the structure. "The doctors are here?" Ibrahima asks. "That is what the others told me," Etienne says. "How would they fix our feet?" "They cut the stuff that makes your toes connect and then bandage them separately. When you take the bandage off, your feet will be like normal again. I don't want anyone cutting my feet. The idea of someone cutting his toes causes the same fear he feels for Marabou to take hold of his body. Etienne touches his shoulder. Don't worry, you don't have to get it done. Will you do it? Ibrahima asks. Maybe. I think they give you special shoes so that you can walk. If I get new shoes, I will do it. Ibrahima is not excited about the idea of knives and feet, but before he is able to communicate his doubt, they are approached by a young Senegalese boy at Etienne's height. Talibé, what are you looking for? The doctor that fixes Talibé feet. We heard they're here at the lighthouse, Fatigue says. Doctors Without Borders? You're too late. The doctors are gone. The group comes to a sudden halt. How do you know? Etienne asks. I live here. My father is one of the lighthouse watchers. Where'd the doctors go? They went to Niger to help with the famine. When will they come back? Fatigue asks. I don't know. They left right before Ramadan, the boy says, then runs off behind them down the hill. Etienne plops down on the ground, kicks off his sandals, and stares at his bare feet. Toes fused together beneath years' worth of calluses and ingrown toenails. Ibrahima sits down next to him and lies back onto the grass. The wind atop the hill brings him relief, and he plucks a blade of grass covered in sea salt, carried along the ocean breeze, and chews on it. They were too late to get their feet fixed, but that is fine with Ibrahima, since he would rather spend the rest of his day thinking of all the things he would do if he had enough time. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Keisha. It was such an interesting passage. We're curious. I'd like to know, can you tell us what your current literary landscape looks like? Maybe if you have a next focus in mind, or if you're reading anything good right now that might push your next book?
Yes. Oh, I love that. So my world, there's a lot going on, actually, even though it's so funny when there's a lot going on, but we're all at home.
Yeah.
We're locked down. It's like, things are happening, but I'm just in the house. So because the process of getting No Heaven for Good Boys, like the publishing process, took such a long time, I wrote, and instead of just being frustrated that things were going so slowly and there was all this changeover, I tunneled and sort of funneled that energy into my next two books. So I finished my memoir, and earlier this year, I did one more line revision, and I have a second book of fiction that also is from a male protagonist point of view, but from an adult version. And both the books are based here in the U.S., except for the memoir. My family is, my mother and her family are actually from Honduras, and my dad is Black American. So I write about my family in this memoir, and then my move to New York, and then my move actually to West Africa, where I end up meeting the Talibé. So although it's a book about, the memoir is really about my experience as a young Black girl and woman in America, it also plays like an origin story of like who is this person that ended up like changing their life to write a story about these children in Senegal. And I'm working on my writing, my literary and writing life is, I don't know, it's expensive, I would say, in the sense of like, as a writer, I have another sort of a creative nonfiction project coming down the line at some point. And then in terms of my fiction work is literary, but I'm actually working on sort of a literary sci-fi right now.
Oh, fun.
And this character just came and kept irritating me and bothering me. She wouldn't go away. I was just like, I'm in the middle of something. This happened last year, right in the heart of lockdown, in our first lockdown. And I was just like, I'm working on something else. And
it's like, no, you're not.
Yes. And so I am fully in it. I first thought it was a short story. And then I thought it was a novelette. And then I thought it was a novella. And I think that was me just sort of fighting. Like, this is just going to be something really quick. I dip my toe in and dip out. And it's a novel. And so I'm just fine with it at this point. And then I have another work in progress, which is a literary like dystopian, but it has nothing to do with the virus, thank goodness. And I started that back in 2016. So no viruses, please. Like, we're all over it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know. You know, it's like, it's so depressing. And I see people with COVID on TV shows, and I'm like, I don't want to watch a COVID narrative on my TV. I want to escape.
Right. We've had enough. We've lived it. I have one last question for you, Keisha. What have you learned on your path to becoming an author, and what advice would you offer new writers?
There's so much, but I would say one of the things that, number one, I often wanted or would question whether or not I was a writer. So I have a test that I do, or I would do before I was published, where I said, okay, you know what? I'm not going to write anymore. I quit. And I'd say this one day and any day. And then I say, okay, what's next? And I would realize, like, the what's next, to go back to a traditional 9-to-5, just wasn't in the cards anymore. From very early on, I considered myself a writer. I think when I started writing for No Heaven for Good Boys, I'm like, you know, I'm a writer, and no, I'm not published yet, but that's just who I am. I think writers need to know, especially new writers, aspiring writers, that every path looks different. So don't just follow the path that you think you're supposed to take in the sort of in the vein of if you're writing a book, you should also be publishing short stories, which is a great path. But for me, short stories take so much work that I could just finish my first draft of a novel in the amount of time a really good short story takes. And so instead of pursuing...
So how quickly do you think you can write a novel? This is a curious calculation.
So I've had every project is different, but my first draft of No Heaven for Good Boys came out in 6 months. And that tends to be like, that's a fast, sort of a fast novel. Although the memoir, I wrote 120 pages over the course of a year. And then I wrote, which was about 20,000 words. Almost 30,000 words. And then I wrote 60,000 words in 3 weeks.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and so the memoir ended up being this looming 95,000 word project. But between those two writing bursts, one took a year, and then the next burst came, I would say, 4 years later. And then 60,000 words in 3 weeks, like, these doors just flew open. And so... everything at this point in my life is taking much slower, I'll be honest. But I'm like, you know what? It's a pandemic. And I have actually been writing small pieces. Like, I have a couple pieces. I have a piece, a review in The Rumpus. I'm a huge fan of poetry. And I have a piece in Electric Lit and then Lit Hub.
Also. Oh, wow. That's lots of stuff. That's great.
Yeah. So I have been juggling. If you're going to write and get pieces published, then know that your manuscript is going to might move much slower, you know, because this is energy that you're putting towards things. And I've also, in the last couple of months, I've been commissioned to write stories, one for Scholastic and then another for Common Lit. So working on those two projects also. So I would say for writers to... No Heaven for Good Boys kept me going through all of this, through the actual writing of it, and then through a pretty tumultuous sort of like publishing experience. Like, this is not 5 years and five editors is not the dream publishing experience. It's actually like the horror story.
Right? It's a nightmare.
It is. And what kept me going through it was the boys in this book. And so I would say for new writers, write about something that you're passionate about, because that is going to keep you going. Finding that passion takes free writing. It takes searching internally about what matters for you, or it's just about listening to that character who comes and like smacks you. And you're like, hold up, you know, I don't have room for you. And the character's like, I am going to harass you. and stay on your mind for weeks on end, you know, until you start, you know, writing my story, because I have so much to say. So I think that passion and not being afraid, because I've also bumped into writers who are like, I have this story, but it might be nonfiction, you know, based on family, and they're too afraid to write it. And I'm just like, write it in secret, dude. Like, do what you need to do, but like, don't run from the story.
That's great advice. That's really wonderful advice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today at Book Tales. We really love talking to you and hearing you read your work.
It was such a pleasure.
Yay. And everyone, please order Keisha's book, No Heaven for Good Boys, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.